Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Bob Fraser. Bob's the past director of the Division of Public Health and a principal figure in the effort to control tuberculosis in Alaska. We'll be discussing some of the history of tuberculosis control in Alaska and address your questions and comments. If you've got questions or comments during the program today, you can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And we'll also be taking emails for the next next hour at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Bob, welcome to Line One.
Thank you, Thad.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. And I might mention to our listeners, Bob's wife, Shirley Fraser, who is a neurologist, is also in the studio with us today. Shirley, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Thad.
Shirley didn't want anybody to know she was even on the face of the earth today. Well, Bob, I'd like to know, what we'd like to do is talk about tuberculosis to some degree, but I'd also like to hear a little bit about how you got here and your training and so forth, if you don't mind taking it. Before we got him on the air, I understood you came up here in the mid-50s or so for the first time.
Yes, I came up to Alaska in 1955.
Uh-huh.
And worked at Mount Edgecombe in Sitka in southeastern Alaska, and just loved it. There was a lot of tuberculosis in the hospital. I became very interested in tuberculosis. And then I went back and did some more training, and then I came back to Alaska again after my internship, and went up to Kotzebue, where I had spent some time and really enjoyed it. The tuberculosis epidemic must have been one of the most memorable epidemics in the history of our country and indeed of the world. In the 1950s, the incidence of positive tuberculin skin tests in the school systems was very high. In 1956-57, positive tuberculin tests in some areas of Alaska bordered on 90%. So it was a real problem, and lots of young kids, young kids were dying of TB meningitis early. And there was a lot of bone and joint tuberculosis involving spine and hip and knees and elbows. And it was just an overwhelming disease.
So you came up here as a medical student to Mount Edgecombe then?
Yes.
And at the time, Mount Edgecombe was a school where many of the natives sent their children for their principal education during the school.
Yeah, for high school.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yes, but Mount Edgecombe was also a hospital.
Uh-huh.
It had been an Indian health hospital before, and during the 50s, when tuberculosis was so prevalent and there weren't many other hospitals, Mount Edgecombe was the major hospital.
What were the, was the hospital and the the high school in the same building, or are we looking at different buildings?
No, they're different buildings.
Uh-huh.
There were Mount Edgecombe. Sitka is a community on Baranof Island.
Right.
And off of Sitka is Jampansky Island, uh-huh. And this is where the school and the hospital were located. It was a ferry ride. Now there's a bridge from Sitka to Mount Edgecombe.
So the children were boarded in the school as well?
Yes.
And what I'm getting at is that probably didn't help in the control of tuberculosis efforts to have a whole lot of potentially contagious native children in a single barracks-like situation.
Well, the kids were screened before they went in there. And so there wasn't any active tuberculosis in the school. There was occasionally, but...
Uh-huh.
They were pretty well screened before.
prior to the 50s, then, when you mentioned there was a big epidemic, was there always an endemic kind of situation in Alaska that kind of exploded in the 50s, or had there been intermittent large outbreaks?
There wasn't very much in the way of study or control until the 50s, and then Alaska took over responsibility for Alaska, or the United States took over responsibility for Alaska in the 1880s. There really wasn't a whole lot in the way of programs until the late 40s and early 50s.
Yeah. So that was kind of at the rise of medical science, so people began to finally keep track of what was going on, is what you're saying.
They found that there's an enormous amount of tuberculosis.
Uh-huh. Is that unusual among Native Americans? I'm thinking about, what about Native Americans in the lower 48? Do they also, or did they also, have tremendous problems with tuberculosis?
Yes, they did.
Uh-huh. Is that some genetic innate problem, or is it this issue of you got a very susceptible population that got exposed to...
It's most likely a relatively new disease in a susceptible population.
Right, right. So after you came up here as a medical student and were at Mount Edgecombe, you went back to get more training. In the training you sought, was that somewhat related to your interest that you'd found about tuberculosis up here?
Well, I went back for training in internal medicine.
Uh-huh.
And then I took a pulmonary fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania with Dr. Bob Mayock. And then I went to London and worked at Brompton Hospital, which was a big chest hospital in London. Mm-hmm. And then I came back and did some more training in Philadelphia. And then I went over to England for some more training at Brompton Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Eventually they recruited you back up here.
Yeah, eventually they recruited me back up here, and I love it. I've never wanted to leave Alaska, and I subsequently haven't, really.
Let me remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Bob Fraser. Dr. Fraser was a past director of the Division of Public Health, and between 64 and 87, roughly, he was one of the major figures in the TB control efforts in Alaska. If you've got questions or comments about those kinds of efforts and tuberculosis in Alaska, let me encourage you to give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, you can always email us at line1@kska.org. Was there some particular individual that recruited you to Alaska?
No, I don't think so.
Well, wait a minute, Bob. Earl Albrecht.
Well, yes, I did have communication with Earl Albrecht, who was the first commissioner of health.
Uh-huh.
For
and this was when we were not a state yet.
No, this is territorial.
Uh-huh.
And I had communication with Earl Albrecht, and he was at Jefferson Medical School where in Philadelphia,
yeah.
And I had met him.
Uh-huh.
And he was very interested in encouraging my interest in Alaska because he'd been the first commissioner of health for the territory of Alaska and first commissioner of statehood.
Did his interest in you relate to your interest in tuberculosis and the state's problems?
I think problems? So. Uh-huh. I think so.
Uh-huh. Were there other places in the world that were suffering the kind of problems we were at this time, or was this kind of the place to be for tuberculosis?
No, many other places were.
Uh-huh.
It depended on whether there'd been a history of tuberculosis, whether there was a tuberculosis control program. But there are many places in the world where tuberculosis was widespread and represented a real problem. In Africa, tuberculosis was very widespread, in the Congo and other areas. In Southeast Asia, it was a major problem. England, it's not a major problem by the 50s, but it was an ongoing problem. So tuberculosis has been a a very widespread disease throughout the world.
Can you, I know for me it would be difficult to go back in my mind and remember specifically, but do you remember at that point in the mid-50s, early 60s when you were doing this, what was the understanding of tuberculosis at that time? How was it spread? How was it diagnosed? What were we going to do to stop this problem?
Well, that was a very interesting problem in Alaska because here we had this disease that was very well widespread in a rural state without much in the way of medical services. And so the first problem was to determine how widespread the disease was. Mm-hmm. Well, they did tuberculin testing, and lo and behold, they found that many of the elementary schools were tuberculin positive, and after up to high school level, they were all tuberculin positive. And there was a lot of infectious disease, so it was a widespread disease in children and in adults and in Alaska. The symptoms of tuberculosis. Well, the symptoms of tuberculosis are varied. When young children get infected with the tuberculosis, they have fever, they feel sick, and it's a prolonged illness. When adults get sick with tuberculosis, they frequently have cough and sputum production and sometimes blood in their sputum and fever, and this goes on for a while, and they eventually become debilitated. And if they don't get treatment, eventually they'll die. Mm-hmm. And so if you looked at the Alaskan population, the rural Alaskan population, the native Alaskan population in the 50s and 60s, almost every community in every rural community in Alaska had a lot of tuberculosis, and the incidence of disease was very high.
Once tuberculosis gets into a community, as you said, it's more of a chronic disease. It's not like an acute febrile illness that you're over quickly. You get infected, and then you may continue to have and harbor that organism for years and years and years, and it may, in a sense, recrudesce. It may again break out and cause illness during times of childbearing, when women are pregnant or with chronic diseases, other chronic diseases affecting it. Did that contribute to the problems in the natives?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how about the living style? Was there a reason to think that natives living in closer contact in larger groups of individuals in small villages, is that also contribute in some way?
Well, one thing that was quite apparent was that if there was one active case of tuberculosis in a village, someone who had a hole in their lung, a cavitary disease, that everybody in their household, since the households were small, would likely be infected. And everybody in the small communities were intimate contacts, mm-hmm. so that everybody in the community would get disease. Mm-hmm. So there would be times when you'd find maybe a third of the population had active tuberculosis in a small community.
Mm-hmm. And they're relatively close contact. I'm just imagining how that must have been in a closed community that probably got together. And then if somebody was particularly had a cavitary lesion or had a cough with it, they would spread that illness quite
That's right.
easily to
Yes.
others. In the early 50s, early 60s, already there was skin testing being done to determine what?
Whether people had been infected.
Mm-hmm.
And there were early efforts to control the disease. For example, BCG immunizations against tuberculosis were tried quite extensively in southeastern Alaska in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that information was available. And then the question was, well, how to get a handle on it? And the territory developed a team of portable x-rays that they could carry around to the villages and an x-ray technician. And so they'd go to the small villages and x-ray everybody in the village. And public health nurses were beginning to go out to the communities, and they'd tuberculin test all the preschool and school children so they'd find out who all was infected. Mm-hmm. And then the x-ray teams were developed, and they'd go out and x-ray all those who were tuberculin positive. And then the x-rays would be interpreted, and those people with active disease would be called into a hospital. And then as time went on and medication became available, particularly isoniazid, which first became available in about 1951, and it was an oral pill, and it was rather simple to take. And so the Public Health Service embarked on a study in Alaska where they put some whole communities in rural Alaska on isoniazid. Everybody in the community took isoniazid for mm-hmm. a year. Mm-hmm. And
did they know really? I mean, we know now it's 9 months, 10 months, 12 months of treatment with INH. Was it clear at that point how long you needed to take isoniazid?
Yes, yes. Huh. And they had, it was a real problem because of the limitation of health personnel in rural villages.
Uh-huh.
The health care at that early in the 50s was administered by a regional public health service hospital, a state public health nurse who visited the community maybe 4 or 5 times a year. And they were beginning to train in small individual villages health aides. These were people from the villages who went off and received a little bit of training and were able to give medication, give antibiotics, and keep track of health problems in the village. So all this is a very exciting time in Alaska, as anybody who's been in rural Alaska in the last 25 years recognizes. And it still is very exciting to go out to rural Alaska.
For our listeners, I want to get back to this diagnosis of tuberculosis. So a TB test, or what's commonly called a PPD right now, used to be a different kind of test called a Tyne test. It tells individuals who have a reaction to that they've been exposed to and infected. Doesn't necessarily mean they're sick at that time. Is that correct?
That's right.
And then the chest x-ray gave a better idea of the extent of their disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned cavitary lesions. So this organism could cause tremendous destruction to the lung. And when it did that, you had a cough, sometimes a bloody cough. And those were, in my mind, those were terribly contagious people.
Yes, they were.
So that's what you were looking for. And did you ever seroconvert? Did you ever become a PPD positive patient?
Oh, yes, I did. And I took medication.
Yeah.
Yes, I attribute it to one experience. We went up to a small community,
uh-huh.
and we were looking for, there had been a number of active cases of tuberculosis, people who had just converted to tuberculin tests and had x-ray evidence of disease.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were something like 10 people in this small community, a community of about 500 people. And so we went up there to try to find the active case, and we took an x-ray technician and we x-rayed people, and then we tried to figure out who hadn't been x-rayed, who was around in the community, and so we thought we'd got everybody. And then one evening we went to a little bar that was in the town, and we sat there and we visited. And here was a barfly who was coughing.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to him, and we asked him if he'd had an x-ray, and he hadn't. Mm-hmm. And we eventually persuaded him to go get a chest x-ray, and he got the x-ray, and he had far advanced disease, and mm-hmm. he was carted off to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But that was some of the work in the...
And that's where you think you may have what we call
That's where I may have gotten infected, because I was fairly close to this man for an evening, and then on the plane in to the hospital.
And a reason why you never became very sick with tuberculosis is the reason we treat those individuals who become positive with a PPD is that is it we then know that you're infected, we treat you for a year to keep this from activating later. Is that the way tuberculosis works?
That's right, yes. Okay. And I did that. Mm-hmm. I was a good patient.
And there's no reason why you couldn't get reinfected again, however.
No, and there's no reason that that scars in my lung might not break down, and then I could have disease again, too.
So it is a very, very difficult organism.
But I'm not counting on it.
Yeah, very, very difficult organism to eradicate completely. But we know those people who do undergo INH, this isoniazid, for a year or so are very, very unlikely compared to others.
Yes, and so that was... The case-finding activities and the use of INH were primarily responsible for our ability to largely eliminate tuberculosis in Alaska. And we went in Alaska from an instance of tuberculosis in Alaska, which was far higher on a per capita basis than anywhere else in the country, to an instance is now lower than the average among the states.
Mm-hmm. Does PPD or the Tyne test, if that's what you were doing, have to be refrigerated? I'm just thinking about the physical difficulties of doing the testing, getting an X-ray in Kotzebue in the 50s or 60s, or Barrow, or Wainwright, or something like that. You know, I've interviewed people who are trying to do measles control in Africa right now, and the cold chain kind of problems, just the technical difficulties. I can't imagine having to do X-rays all over the state.
Well, at that time. Doing X-rays isn't a problem with a portable unit.
Oh, golly. How big and how heavy was the portable unit?
The portable unit was probably about 60 pounds.
Uh-huh.
Not very heavy.
And you were flying these.
We had three X-ray technicians in the territory, and sometimes they'd go together, and sometimes they'd go individually to villages, and they'd go out with their X-ray unit and set it up and run people through, work with the health aide and volunteers, and people were used to. But after a few years, they were pretty used to these X-ray technicians coming, and they were very cooperative. And so they just line them up and take the X-rays and then bring them back and develop them, process them.
Uh-huh. Seems amazing to me. And treatment is the other issue. I mean, even today, getting people to take
medicine.
12 months of medicine it's hard to get people to take 10 days. And I'm not being critical of patients because I tell my patients all the time it took 30 or 40 years to get people to dentist to get me to floss my teeth. So it takes habit changes are difficult. But anyway, not that long ago they started doing direct observation, making sure somebody watched people take the medications. And I guess if health aides kind of originated in this period where health aides used to help get these medications into individuals for a 12-month period of time.
Well. Health aides encourage patients to take the medicine. But you're right. The hardest problem was motivating people to take any medicine for a long period of time. Gee, it's even hard to get women to take their birth control pills on a regular basis.
Right. No, it's compliance and adherence is difficult for a number of reasons, even for physicians who are patients. All right. Why don't we take a short break? I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And, of course, you can always email us at line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to interview Dr. Bob Frazier and take any emails or calls that come in on Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Dr. Bob Frazier. Bob is a past director of the Alaska Division of Public Health and one of the principal individuals leading TB control efforts in Alaska. He was very intimately involved beginning in 1964 as chief of the what was that time called the Unit of TB Control through his retirement in 1987 in efforts to control tuberculosis in Alaska. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@kska.org. Call us directly here in Anchorage, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the usual warning, if you're listening tonight between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast. There won't be anybody there to answer your questions or take your email. So if you got some questions that you'd like answered, this is the time to do it. Bob, we did get an email. It says, one old-time MD who was involved in treating tuberculosis in the early days told this writer that on retrospect, it may have been less disruptive to the native culture and family life if tuberculosis patients had been treated in their villages with an extensive program on sanitation and hygiene rather than the medication route. What are your thoughts on that question or that comment? Could sanitation and hygiene been as effective as the medical approach?
No. Tuberculosis in most individuals requires treatment, and the rifampin and isoniazid and streptomycin, which was used in PA, they're good medications, but they have to be taken regularly.
Mm-hmm. So purely cleaning up, bathing, not having people living closer together may have had an impact on spread, but as far as those individuals who were really, really sick, it was not going to be an answer.
No, it would not be an effective management.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that even in the history of tuberculosis that is a huge issue. I mean, tuberculosis was a major issue in the United States, even among the well-to-do, in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
May I interject here?
Sure.
Eleanor Roosevelt had it,
right.
Died of it.
Right.
A famous movie actor, the one actress that played in Gone with the Wind, can't think of her name right now, she had it and died of it.
Yeah. So it's interesting how tuberculosis is just one of those diseases that hangs on, and all the factors and all the reasons why we have recurrences or epidemics are, at least in my mind, are not entirely understood. But certainly in poor hygienic situations, it may be a bigger role.
Yes. And one of the problems is that people can be infected with tuberculosis germs and not have any symptoms for years.
Mm-hmm.
The germs can... A person can breathe in the germs and they'll settle in the lung and there's a scar. And, they may never get sick during their life, or they may get sick 50 years later, or they may get sick progressively weeks and months after the initial infection. But the big problem is that the infection is frequently hidden.
If I were to ask you how contagious is it, how would you answer that question relative to a common cold, for example?
Relative to a common cold. Well, I suspect it's less contagious than a common cold.
Mm-hmm.
But if a person has active tuberculosis, particularly if they have a little hole in their lung, a cavity, and the germs are multiplying rapidly, they're quite infectious. And so there's histories of people exposed very transiently to somebody with active tuberculosis who get infected. And in Alaska, we had cases that infected a large number of people in the small communities.
How's it transmitted? Is it basically through the air?
It's airborne. The person who has the disease coughs, puts out an aerosol of droplet particles carrying TB germs, and the non-infected person breathes them in, just like a cold is transmitted.
Is there much difference among individuals in susceptibility to tuberculosis? Are there things, some people, for reasons that maybe you know that I don't know why, some people may not be as susceptible to acquiring it despite exposure?
I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. I went for many, many years exposed to tuberculosis and never having a positive tuberculin skin test. I eventually did, but, I must have been exposed to a wide variety of germs. And then somebody deposited germs in my lung and I became tuberculin positive. And then I developed a little active disease.
It's always been somewhat curious to me, and I have to admit I've never researched it hard enough to know this transmission and individual susceptibility. I know in the 70s I spent 6 months in a tuberculosis hospital in training, and in that TB hospital, there was nothing in that hospital but patients with tuberculosis. The only time we ever wore masks is when we were in the room with someone with a cavitary lesion, that was coughing, and I didn't convert either. And then I've just heard about individuals who work with individuals with tuberculosis and don't convert, and I don't know maybe it's just luck, but it seems a curious phenomenon sometimes. I have another email. This is from one of our regular listeners, and she says, an RN who worked for the Native Hospital in the 70s had to learn cribbage in order to interact with her patients, who were often away from their villages for long periods of time. They must have been the case for some decades, because I've met many elderly Native people over the years who spent years in the hospital, usually due to tuberculosis, and they are absolutely the best cribbage players that she'd ever met. So a couple of comments there is, does it often take long periods of hospitalization, or has it in the past to treat that this particular illness?
Yes.
Yeah.
And, some people have had exposure to tuberculosis throughout their life and never had any trouble, and then suddenly when they begin to get a little older, they develop active disease. And this is not a new infection. This is a reactivation of their previous infection, which may have been 50 years before.
Some of these people who are hospitalized for long times develop skills, such as Robert Mayakok. He's a very well-known Native artist, and he developed his skills when he was hospitalized for TB.
And it does require sometimes months and months of hospitalization, particularly if they're very, very sick, getting daily medications and then monitoring whether or not they're progressing or not.
It may require a couple of years.
Sometimes surgery was, as I understand it, was necessary to cut out a diseased portion of the lung even.
There was a lot of surgery done in Alaska in the 50s and 60s.
So, but the disease, at least in the really broad spectrum of it, when you're seeing so much of it, is not necessarily limited to the lung. You can get meningitis, as you said, and arthritis, and even skin. And I know the larynx was a not an uncommon place to have tuberculosis.
Yes, there was a lot of bone tuberculosis in Alaska in the 50s and before. And there was quite a program. Phil Moore in Sitka started, well, he didn't start it, but he fundamentally did, I guess. And there would be any anywhere from 30 to 40 patients at any one time hospitalized in Sitka with bone TB. And bone TB was pretty common in Anchorage as well. Mm-hmm. And the treatment involves the same drug therapy with isoniazid and rifampin. And it just takes a long time. And sometimes they have to do surgery if it's arthritis. It can also, the TB germ can also involve the kidney. So a lot of people had renal tuberculosis, which is also a bad disease.
My recollection from learning about tuberculosis, and I have to say is in private practice, I just have not seen much since I was in training, was that one of the principal individuals, well, two groups of people I would think of that the organism would relapse if it was not treated with this INH once you had it and you appeared healthy for a number of years, was pregnant women during pregnancy, and then, of course, the elderly maybe during just being older or when they develop cancer or some other problem. Did you see, was it true that pregnancy was a significant risk factor for those Native Americans or Native Alaskans that had tuberculosis?
Yes, I wasn't overwhelmingly impressed. But I saw it occasionally. Yes, uh-huh. It does occur.
How about some memorable experiences or memorable individuals you met? You mentioned a little brief period about a pilot in Kotzebue that you got to know pretty well flying around.
Oh. Well, there were lots of experiences flying around Alaska.
Uh-huh.
If you can imagine, I've been to about every community in Alaska at one time or another.
Uh-huh.
And I've had some exciting experiences in small planes. I had an experience with Tommy Richards, who was a very nice man who flew for Ween Airlines. He was an Eskimo man himself.
Uh-huh.
And he had a busy career flying with Ween Airline around Alaska. He flew for years. He was a great pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And John Cross was another man that I recall who flew a small single-engine plane out of Kotzebue. And I think I would fly to hell with Tommy if I had to. Trusted
him quite a bit.
Yeah.
I know when I first came up here, I worked with you. I was fortunate enough to work for you as with an epidemiologist assigned here from the Center for Disease Control. And I had an experience where I went into one of the local hospitals to get some information about probably pertussis, I don't remember specifically, and was chased out of the hospital because nobody wanted to give the state any information at that time. So my question is, how easy was it for you to go into the villages and get acceptance in what you were trying to do?
Oh, I don't think it was very difficult. I went in a very mild manner and talked to them and usually developed friendships with many of the people in rural Alaska, so I didn't have much trouble. There were a few places that sort of resented an outsider coming in, but not very many. Most people were recognized that you're coming into their community, offering a service, and they should take advantage of it.
I want to take just a brief second. I have been remiss. When we took our break, I wanted to make sure I mentioned that there is one of the yearly prostate clinics that are going on in the community this week. Tonight, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, from 4 to 7, at Alaska Regional Hospital in Suite 101, you can get your prostate exam and get a PSA test done. You can get more information by calling 276-1474. So that's Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, 4 to 7, and also this Saturday from 10 to 1. And I apologize for not doing that during our break time. It's an important opportunity for everyone men to take advantage of. Some people that get the PPD test or the Tyne test may have a positive test that's really not real. It's what's called a false positive. Was that a problem, or was there so much tuberculosis it was relatively easy to conclude these were really infected people?
Well, I think the problem of tuberculosis was so significant that a false positive gave us very little concern. First of all, many of the false positives are not strongly positive. Uh-huh. And most of the ones positive tuberculin results in Alaska were not questionable. They were quite strong reactions.
We remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Bob Frazier. He was director of the Division of Public Health here for a number of years and has also been instrumental in some of the TB control, especially since the late 50s, early 60s. And if you've got questions or comments about any of these efforts or tuberculosis in general, this is an opportunity to ask someone who's very knowledgeable about these issues. And our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at during the next 20 minutes or so at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at ksk.org. How about resistance? Nowadays, we are somewhat concerned about multiply resistant tuberculosis, which means organisms that are resistant to some of the more common treatments, drug treatments, which we've discussed earlier, like INH and Rifamp. And, did y'all run into that in the early 60s or 70s, or was that a later problem?
There was a little bit of drug resistance, but not very much then. Now drug resistance is becoming more and more of a problem. We've had a few cases of multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis in Alaska, which have developed. They developed in people who took their medications irregularly and missed long periods of time, and whose germs became resistant. There have been a few people who have been infected with drug-resistant tuberculosis. Drug-resistant tuberculosis occurs, but it has not been a major problem in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for that, in your opinion? I mean, it's certainly a
problem.
It's always a good friend to have when you're doing infectious diseases. I mean, one of the reasons for drug resistance is incomplete treatment, people stopping treatments and so forth. So we certainly were anybody's treating outbreaks. That's a primary problem.
That's right.
Robert Fortune has written a book, and I put a link to the Amazon website that sells this book. It's called Must We All Die? Alaska's Enduring Struggle with Tuberculosis. I had the opportunity, since you brought a copy in here, to look at the timeline in the back, and you made the timeline in a couple of ways. Any comments on the book or some of the things that you saw in the book that caught your attention?
No, I think it's a good book, and it's... Uh-huh. He's done a good job with it.
And he starts back in the 1700s even, documenting some of the issues with tuberculosis in Alaska. Looks like we have a caller. I think I'll go ahead and take that phone call as well. Marty, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, Dr. Woodard. I had a TB test in the early 70s here in Anchorage at the health clinic. Because my son tested positive, and they had me come in and tested me. And I was very sure that when they looked at my test result, they did not look at it correctly, because I had a scar very close to the little TB time test. And the time test, really, there was nothing there, but they insisted that the scar...
Yeah.
was a positive.
Right.
So I went ahead and had the whole year's worth of medication, as well as my son. And I was just wondering, are there any repercussions after, you know, you get older?
Yeah.
For having had the year's worth drugs, or is it just okay because, you know, are you protected now more than you would be? Or
all right. Well, let's ask the expert here. Dr. Frazier, do you understand the question?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
even if your test was not real and you had the INH for a year, you were protected from a risk of developing tuberculosis if you had been infected. Now, you know, you could go to the health center and get retested if you wanted to be sure whether you were still positive or whether that was a false positive and you were really still negative. And that you could do for the matter of personal interest.
So, yeah, what Dr. Frazier's commenting on, once you're positive, you're always positive for that INH. Treatment does not make it negative. So if you went back and got another test and it was now negative, then it probably was almost certain that that was a false positive then. There is some side effects to taking INH. Sometimes there's some mild liver toxicity, rarely anything serious at the time you're taking it. But long-term, I'm not aware of any long-term risks at all. That fair to say?
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, and by the way, just because you took INH for a year then doesn't mean you can't get reinfected again now. So it's not a lifelong protection, unfortunately, either.
Ah.
That's another thing I've heard you say that I wanted to comment on.
And thank you very much. I wasn't aware of that either.
Yep. Unfortunately, that's the situation. Yep.
Oh, I appreciate your program.
All right. Well, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
When did the Public Health Service or the Native Health Service begin to take more active role in Native health, but in particular tuberculosis?
The Public Health Service began to take an active role in tuberculosis in the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Was the Native Health Service there at that particular time, or was that a separate development?
The Native Health Service was moving in,
uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay. Right. And today in Alaska, I know you've retired in the 80s. It's been a while. The state still has some responsibility for outbreak control.
Yes.
Are there still people going around taking x-rays at Native villages, or how's it done today?
No, unfortunately, the x-ray technicians have all retired and have not been replaced.
Yeah.
And while occasionally, I'm sure, a situation occurs where you'd like to be able to take an x-ray unit into the village, I don't think that any of the x-ray technicians are trained to do that now. So if somebody develops active tuberculosis in Quetzaloc or Savunga or some village away from the medical center, then it's up for the public health nurse to do tuberculin testing and the local physician from the regional hospital to recommend what should be done. And people would be sent in to have an x-ray at their local hospital.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've mentioned the health aides and the important role they've played. We've really not perhaps commented enough on the role the public health nurses played. I know at the time I came up in 78 and worked as an epidemiologist, I really found that it was extremely important to work with public health nurses to understand what was going on from a disease standpoint throughout the state. Was that a finding, or were they critically important to you as well?
Well, I think extremely important. I think that Alaska has a long history of excellent public health nurse coverage, mm-hmm. and they're an excellent healthcare provider in the communities. They can supervise medication, they educate people, they take care of active patients when they're there, they are active in training the health aides, and so they're a very important member of the team. And I think that public health and preventive therapy is a very important aspect of public health.
I remember a name of Elfrieda Nord, who worked at the time I was up here, and she was going around. Was she taking X-rays at that particular time, or was she a public health nurse? I'm trying to remember. And where I'm going with this is not only trying to remember some of the names of these individuals, but did other people have problems with acquiring tuberculosis, or friends, or physicians, people involved in the care that you know of ever have any real difficulties having acquired tuberculosis while working up here?
Oh, I think the occasional physician has. Well, the public health nurses have been extremely important in the public health program in Alaska. And Elfrieda Nord was the chief of public health nursing for a while. But she worked, she was a tuberculosis control nurse and excellent person.
Right.
She was good at teaching nurses, teaching patients. And this is, I think that the vision of public health in Alaska has been somewhat unique in terms of having a group of public health nurses throughout the state who go to every small community and provide excellent preventive therapy.
If I were to ask you one, what's the biggest change you've seen in tuberculosis in the state of Alaska in the since the 50s when you were up here as a medical student, how would you answer that question?
Been the virtual elimination of active cases of tuberculosis in most of the state. The incidence of tuberculosis, of new infections and tuberculosis in Alaska, have gone from the greatest incidence in the country to a fairly low incidence.
Okay, so it's reasonable to say, although we haven't eradicated it, and no one's eradicated tuberculosis in the world, the control efforts that were initiated in the 50s and 60s were quite successful.
Been extremely successful.
Here's another email. It says, in the early 60s, just out of California nursing school, I worked in Mexico for 2 years, where I saw lots of tuberculosis. Within 6 months of returning to California after this experience in Mexico, I was tested positive for TB with probably a PPD or Tyne test. I took INH and rifampin for a year. I'm sure my skin test is still positive. She doesn't say whether she took it or not. Also, a drug, I cannot recall the name, was given to children in foreign countries such as Japan, which gives a positive skin test results. Thanks. Enjoyed your discussion. You'd mentioned this drug in the past, and that was BCG, I think is what she's referring to. What was BCG, and what was all that about? What was
BCG was an attenuated tuberculosis germ that had been grown and grown and grown so that it no longer caused disease, which would be given and cause an infection that caused a positive tuberculin test but didn't cause disease. And it was used quite a bit in the early territorial days, been used quite a bit elsewhere in the country. Now is used, I think, occasionally.
It was a different effort to try to control tuberculosis by somewhat giving an immune response.
That's right.
Did it work?
Yeah, although there's always been questions about its efficacy, but yeah. I think it worked.
And one of the downside that this email that we got is that once you get that kind of test, you're always positive, which sometimes could be a little bit confusing. Shirley, you're shaking your hand.
No, the BCG, one of its problems is that some people got a good response and others did not respond at all. Mm-hmm. And the protection against tuberculosis was short-lived.
Yeah, so it wasn't as effective as we hoped it would be. And that's one of the reasons why it never became a big way to try to control tuberculosis in the United States, is my understanding. Although other countries in the world used it quite a bit. I know in the Philippines, I think in India, it was used quite a bit.
Yeah, they used it in England for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've only got a couple of minutes, Bob. What are the final thoughts you want to leave us about your experiences or tuberculosis?
Well, I think tuberculosis has been a fascinating disease and a very interesting disease. It's largely gone in Alaska, and I won't be sorry to see it go, although I'll miss many of the memories and experiences. And I hope that I can say in another 20 years, well, we haven't had a case of tuberculosis in a long time.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's just been a real pleasure to have the opportunity to sit down and talk with you. I'm embarrassed that I had worked with you for a number of years and didn't know all the important history that you had brought to the state and all the efforts you'd made. And so it's been a great pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thanks, Sam.
I know infectious diseases, we always think we've gotten a grip on them. When I was in training and thinking about going into infectious diseases, a fellowship, people were saying, oh, those are all gone. We've got those figured out. Now we know that they keep coming back to haunt us. Well, my thanks again to Bob Frazier, the past director of the Division of Public Health here in Alaska. Our topic has been TB control efforts. Line 1's going to return next week, and we'll be talking with Dr. Andrew Kroger. Dr. Kroger is a specialist on immunizations. He works at the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at what used to be called the Center for Disease Control, and now is the Centers for Disease Control, of which he's a member of this one branch. We'll be discussing reasons for the reluctance of patients and providers. We've never discussed that too much with regards to providing immunizations. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program along with Dave Waldron, who initiated the beginning of the program. I want to thanks to our listeners who called in and emailed in questions. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.